for they are life to those who find them, and healing to all their flesh. Proverbs 4:20-22. I have lost my smile, but don't worry, the dandelion has it.
Nice, we've gotten 30 so far.
Oh,
I count. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. We are a lay-led congregation. We welcome people with a variety of beliefs, background, and races, and are a welcoming congregation to persons of all sexual orientations. I'm Nancy Schroff, and I'm the president. Any guests or visitors will have time later in the service for introductions. Next, we have our children's story, Juan Bobo, a Puerto Rican folktale, by Aaron Brosh Bosch presents.
You can open up in front if you can. We have to share it.
How about
Marie?
Want to
watch it?
I'm busy with the hot chocolate.
Okay, this is called Juan Bobo and the Horse of Seven Colors. On the island of Puerto Rico, there once lived a young shepherd by the name of Juan. Now, Juan was a perfect fool and a simpleton and a dunce. He was known far and wide as Juan Bobo, because Bobo means fool in Spanish. King Luis, whose sheep Juan Bobo watched, was a very wealthy man, but his greatest pride was his beautiful wheat field. One night, a mysterious creature trampled down a portion of the king's wheat. The king was furious. He decreed that his wheat was to be watched every night. A schedule of guards was drawn up. But each night, the result was the same. The guards set to watch the wheat fell asleep, and more of the field was trampled. On the fourth night, it was Juan Bobo's turn to guard the wheat. He left his house carrying a long rope and a sack filled with bread and honey. He whistled as he walked, for he wasn't very worried about guarding the king's wheat. After all, every other guard had fallen asleep and failed. He could scarcely do worse than that. Juan Bobo set his sack next to a large anthill and sat down. Since I can't have anyone visit me, these ants must do for company, he said as he laid out his dinner on his lap. Now, bread and honey make a messy meal, even for the daintiest eater, and Juan Bobo was not a dainty eater. By the time Coqui, the frog, rang out his clear musical notes to signal the sunset, Juan was covered with honey. He stuffed the last bit of bread in his pocket just in case he woke during the night. Then he closed his eyes and rested his head against his empty dinner set. It was then that the ants decided to eat their meal. Ouch! Juan Bobo clapped at a small ant that bit his leg. Ow! He brushed two ants off his belly and one off his neck. Ow, 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 ow! Brother ants, leave me alone, Juan Bobo pleaded. He slapped his brush, but it did no good. Soon he was covered with hungry ants, nibbling at his honey-coated skin. Juan threw himself to the ground and twisted like a madman. Finally, the ants left. Once more, Juan Bobo lay down and closed his eyes, but the ant bites kept him awake. Suddenly, sweet music filled the air. Juan Bobo's eyes grew tired and heavy. He wished the bites would stop itching so he could sleep. Juan Bobo squinted into the darkness. There, in the middle of the king's wheat field, a glorious horse tossed his head and snickered. The horse had a mane and tail of seven vibrant colors, from blue to indigo, yellow to red. They shifted like a rainbow in the night breeze. Forgetting all about his ant bite, Juan stood. He drew out his last piece of bread and honey. Looping his rope over his shoulder, Juan Bobo crept toward the horse. He held out the bread and honey. The horse lowered his head and gently nibbled. Quickly, Juan Bobo tossed his rope around the horse's neck. To Juan Bobo's amazement, the horse spoke. If you will set me free, I will leave this field and never return. And to thank you, I will give you seven hairs for my coat. Juan Bobo pulled his rope away. Each of these hairs will grant you one wish, but use them wisely, my friend. The horse seemed to smile as he spoke. Then he lifted his head and jumped into the air. In the few seconds it took for dawn to break over the mountains, the horse was gone. Certain he had been dreaming, Juan Bobo looked down at his hand. 7 jewel-colored hairs were draped across his palm. As daylight crept over the field, Juan Bobo left for home. When he arrived, he tried to tell his brothers what had happened. "You are such a Bobo," his older brother jeered, before Juan could finish his story. "You should have captured the horse and brought him here. The king would have paid a great reward for a horse of 7 colors. We could all be rich." Juan's younger brother smiled and shook his head. "Let him be, mi hermano. He can't help it if he's a Bobo. Besides, I am ready to leave." "Where are you going?" Juan asked. "Princess Aya has been very ill. The doctors say she will recover, but the princess barely eats and never laughs. King Luis has decreed that the person who can make the princess laugh will receive a great reward." "Bueno, mi hermano, wait for me and I will help you." "There's no time." His brothers walked out the door, waving goodbye. Juan scratched his cheek, then his elbow, then his ear. He picked up the horse's hairs and sighed. He is so bad that he couldn't even think. "I wish there was some medicine covering my bites that would stop them from itching," he said. In an instant, Juan Bobo was covered head to toe with cold, slimy mud. He gasped and looked at his muddy hands. The red hair had disappeared. He raised his hand to scratch his nose, then realized that his nose didn't itch. Now he could think. Juan walked out the door and into the bright sunshine. Before he could decide what to do next, his stomach began to grumble. "I wish I had a sausage as large as my arm, one that never got smaller no matter how much I ate." Before he could blink in surprise, Juan Bobo found that he was holding a thick sausage in his hand. This time, the orange hair had disappeared. Juan Bobo took a bite and began to walk. He walked and he ate, and the sausage grew no smaller. "I know. I'll go to the castle and see how my brothers are doing. But I don't want to embarrass them," he said, looking down at himself. Not only was he covered with mud, but his clothes were completely ruined after his night in the field, dirty, stained, and torn. "I wish I was wearing a suit of clothes as fine as any that the king might wear," he said, slinging the sausage over his back. You know what's going to happen. No sooner was the last word out of his mouth than Juan found himself dressed in blue silk and red velvet. His huge feathered hat sparkled with gems, his black blue boots shone with like mirrors. He barely noticed that the yellow hair had disappeared. "Oh, what a beautiful sight I am," he said, "but I'd hate to see these shiny boots get dirty. I'd better wish for a horse, a big black horse, fine as any in the king's stable." Poof! A large black horse stood in front of him, and the green hair disappeared. Juan Bobo jumped onto the horse's back and grabbed his mane. The black horse reared and clawed at the air. Then he raced off with Juan clinging like a bird to his back. The horse bolted through a thicket of trees. Juan held tight as branches ripped his fine clothes and tore the jewels from his hat. Then the horse reared. Juan Bobo tumbled to the ground, and the huge horse raced away. Oya! Juan jumped to his feet. The air was filled with the buzzing of angry bees. The horse had dumped him right on a huge beehive. "I wish that there was something to keep these bees away from me," Juan said. A flock of birds appeared in the air above Juan Bobo's head. There were red birds and blue, brown, and gray. Some were large and some were small. Each time a bee threatened to sting Juan, one of the birds swooped through the air and snapped it in his beak. "That horse was too big for me," Juan said. "I wish I had an old fat donkey to ride." "Yaw!" A donkey brayed in front of Juan. Now the blue and indigo hairs were both gone. There was only a violet hair left. Juan tucked it in his pocket and climbed on the donkey's back. The animal lumbered slowly down the road. Ignoring the swarming bees and birds, Juan sighed and pulled out his sausage. "It was going to take a long time to get to the castle on this old animal. He might as well eat and enjoy himself." He passed through a small village called Gato, for it was filled with cats. One look at the flock of birds that flew about Juan Bobo's head, and the cat set up a howling and a yowling that was enough to make one deaf. Hissing and clawing, the cats followed Juan, each of them hoping to pounce on a fat bird. Juan Bobo led the donkey through the next village. This village was called Peril, for it was filled with dogs. Such a barking and a growling rose as had not been heard before. And so it was that Juan Bobo finally reached the castle. Princess Aya sat on her balcony with her ladies-in-waiting. All about the courtyard, jugglers juggled and musicians played, but no one could draw even a smile from Princess Aya. Juan Bobo, covered with mud and dressed in torn velvet, looked about as his fat donkey jogged to the middle of the courtyard. A crowd of angry bees buzzed around his head. Singing and whistling, colorful birds dove after the buzzing bees. Hissing and howling, a flurry of cats jumped after the birds. Yipping and baying, a bevy of dogs chased after the cats. Juan sat up straight. With one mud-covered hand, he lifted the tattered hat off his head and bowed. Then he held out his sausage and smiled. Buenos dias, my princess. Would you care for a bite to eat? As the ladies watched in amazement, Princess Aya began to laugh. She laughed so long and loud that her mother and father ran out to see what she was laughing at. Bueno, King Luis said when he saw Juan Bobo. Will you live with us, mi amigo, so my little princess will never be sad again? And so it was agreed. From that day forward, Juan Bobo lived in the castle with the king and queen and Princess Aya. He ate his fill of sausage, bread and honey, and other good things until he was nearly as fat as his old donkey. And all he had to do in return was be a perfect Bobo. The horse of seven colors kept his word and never returned to the king's wheat field. As for the last magic hair, it is tucked under the soft mattress of Juan Bobo's bed. He has everything he could wish for and no use for it at all.
Thank you, Aaron. All the young people can go downstairs for religious education. And we'll start with our first hymn. And the UU hymnal number 184.
No, it's actually 187.
Oh, thank you. I didn't have my reading.
184. What? 184. Yeah.
Be you Lance unto yourself? Okay. Are we all together now with 184?
We're going to do it for twice because it's a very short.
You don't want to do it as a
round. Oh, no.
Okay. Be ye lamps unto yourself.
Everybody want to rise? You know, I'm sorry, but I made the mistake. I practiced 84, so I will do my best to play the
song. Why don't you just play the young? Just play as it's written.
Okay. Okay, I'll go through it twice here.
Well, I'm working for up now, National Computer Services, and I grade 10th grade expository exams. And last week, it's a lot of interesting people do this kind of work. We've got someone from the Congo, someone from Cuba. I sit next to a lady who is a professional vocalist and sings at Grace Episcopal, and we're becoming friends. And last week I said something kind of nice to the team leader, and she looked at me, Betty looked at me, and she said, "You're hopeless." I don't know what that means. Anyway, no, it was very nice because we're becoming friends, so there's... okay, well, I'm going to talk about Walt Whitman. And a few things about Walt Whitman. He wrote in the late 1850s, in that time period. And the landscape in the country was very different back then. There were wide, open, expansive, desolate spaces, and much of the land was unpeopled, and it was a very different era of our development. And one thing that D.H. Lawrence wrote about Whitman and some of his writings and what he saw in our country was that it was this: there was a fourth dimension, and there were people whose souls were unborn, and shadows, people with shadows on the landscape. So there was so much potential, and there was this kind of ambient energy that you could see, you know. And another thing about Whitman, and he does write about this, and you can feel it when I read Whitman, I tremble and I shake, and sometimes I start crying, and I don't read him very much. But, you know, but he's here for me. He is here. And then the other thing is that Whitman also wrote in response to the Protestant Reformation and Lutheranism, and basically the idea that you could find God in your own heart. He's right there. He or she is right there. And he also believed that probably priests and churches' time will have come and gone, you know. And this was actually an effort on his part to create a Bible. It was sort of a fledgling effort. And the third thing about Whitman that makes him very special to me is that my brother Alfred gave me this book in 1972. I was 20 years old. And my brother Alfred introduced me to Whitman. My brother loved poets, he loved writers like no other person I know. And he'd bring this, and he just loved, he would talk to me about these people, like they were real people. It's the one thing that was I really liked about Fred. There's a lot of things I'm critical of him about and all that, but it was something that, you know, he really, and so I didn't learn about Whitman in a university class. My brother learned about him in a university class. He was an English major. But Whitman was someone that my brother really liked, and he gave me this book when I was 20 years old. So I'm going to read one part of this, just to give you a feel and a sense. It's from A Song of Myself. "There is that in me. I do not know what it is, but I know it is in me. Wretched and sweaty, calm and cool, then my body becomes. I sleep long. I do not know it. It is without name. It is a word unsaid. It is not in any dictionary, utterance, symbol. Something it swings on more than the earth I swing on. To it the creation is the friend whose embracing awakens me. Perhaps I might tell more. Outlines. I plead for my brothers and sisters. Do you see, O my brothers and sisters? It is not chaos or death. It is form, union, plan. It is eternal life. It is happiness."
When I was asked to assist with this service, the first thing I thought of is that you don't need to hunt for hope unless you're short on it. Mm-hmm. So right away, the theme for this series brings to mind all the times that you had difficulty. And there's no question that when people are in times of stress, anxiety, depression, one of the most striking things that happen is that they constrict.
They tend to become narrow in many ways, lose interest in things, lose energy, lose the ability to look ahead, and one of the things that they constrict is their thinking. And people begin to think the same thoughts over and over about the same subjects over and over, lose track of the big picture, and lose track of their place and purpose. And this is what literature has helped me with, is reconnect me to those things when I've been losing track of what the big picture really is. It's a great way to gain perspective, and I have a shorthand way of thinking about what is needed at these times. And I'll just give you my little shortcuts. This is one of the things that I use in my own work. Number one, there's more. There's more. Number two, I'm more. I'm more than this narrow, constricted thing that I feel like right now. Number three, I'm not alone. I have help. I have other people doing the same things I'm doing. Number four, this too shall pass. Whatever it is you're suffering, it's going to come to an end like everything else. The time I needed literature the most in my life was when I was in my first year of medical school, which I had moved to a new town, I'd left all the friends I knew and the way of life I knew, and I had taken on a way of learning that was very foreign to me. I had been a science major, and I was used to things that had a logic to them, which medicine didn't, especially at the beginning. It was just fact after fact after fact. Facts that didn't really have a lot of logical progression. Very difficult for me to do. Very little enjoyment or satisfaction in cramming a lot of information and then being tested on it, spitting it out. And literature for me was a way of connecting to everything outside of that narrow world I was in. And I have some examples that I've asked people to read that were all posted on the walls of my room at that time. One poem was sent to me by a friend, and just seeing it reminded me there was someone else with me. Someone else was going through things that knew she could trust me, I could trust her. Others I had found before, but I'd never needed them posted on my wall the way I did them. And then last, I had something that I posted on my bedroom door, and so that I never missed seeing it at least twice, when I got up and opened my door, when I went to bed and shut the door. So first, I'm going to have Lisa read for you an excerpt from Death Comes for the Archbishop by Willa Cather. This is a story about two priests working in a mission, and they are very close friends, and one, Father Valiant, is speaking to his friend. Do you want to
go ahead? Where there is great love, there are always men. One might almost say that an apparition is human vision corrected by divine love. I do not see you as you really are. I see you through my affection for you. The miracles of the church seem to me to rest not so much upon faces or voices or healing power coming suddenly near to us from afar, but upon our perceptions being made finer, so that for a moment our eyes can see and our ears can hear what is there about us all.
Then Aaron is going to read the Desiderata. Many of you may have seen this before. This was author unknown, was found inscribed on a church in New England. And it's hard for me to believe that the language as it exists now is what it was originally, but it's close.
Go placidly amid the noise and haste, and remember what peace there may be in silence. As far as is possible without surrender, be on good terms with all persons. Speak your truth quickly and clearly, and listen to others, even the dull and ignorant, for they too have their stories. Avoid loud and aggressive persons, for they are vexations to the spirit. If you compare yourself with others, you may become vain and bitter, for there will always be greater and lesser persons than yourself. Enjoy your achievements, as well as your plans. He is interested in your career, however humble. It is a real possession in the changing fortunes of time. Exercise caution in your business affairs, for the world is full of trickery. But let this not blind you to what virtue there is. Many persons strive for high ideals, and everywhere life is full of heroism. Be yourself, especially do not feign affection. Neither be cynical about love, for in the face of all aridity and disenchantment, it is as perennial as the breath. Take kindly to the counsel of the years, gracefully surrendering the things of youth. Nurture strength of spirit to shield you in sudden misfortune. But do not distress yourself with imaginings. Many fears are born of fatigue and loneliness. Beyond a wholesome discipline, be gentle with yourself. You are a child of the universe, no less than the trees and the stars. You have a right to be here. And whether or not it is clear to you, no doubt the universe is unfolding as it should. Therefore, be at peace with God, whatever you conceive him to be, and whatever your labors and aspirations, in the noisy confusion of life, keep peace with yourself. With all its sham, drudgery, and broken dreams, it is still a beautiful world. Be careful. Strive to be happy.
Bob will read a poem by William Stafford called Ask Me.
Ask Me. Sometimes when the river is ice, ask me mistakes I have made. Ask me what I have done with my life. Others have come in their slow way into my thought, and some have tried to help or to hurt. Ask me what difference their strongest love or hate has made. I will listen to what you say. You and I can turn and look at the silent river and wait. We know the current is there, hidden, and there are comings and goings from miles away that hold the stillness exactly before us. What the river says, that is what I say.
And what was probably the most help to me is what was inside my bedroom door. Short and to the point, Larry.
This too shall pass.
Okay, I guess I'm not all here. Okay. I'd like to read a short segment of a long essay entitled The Reader and the Writer by Christoph Wolff, the formerly East German writer considered to be one of the top two or three post-war German writers. And in this country, Patterns of Childhood, her growing up in Nazi Germany, is probably best known. In her essay, The Reader and the Writer, she asks us that some magical force has managed to erase from her brain every trace of prose literature she's ever read. What would I be missing, she said. And I'm reading just a few excerpts. Let's try this mental experiment. What would I be missing? The answer is not just murderous, it is impossible. But if it were possible, we would have more exact information about how literature affects us. Suppose I begin by killing off inside me the pure, innocently suffering Snow White and her wicked stepmother, who at the end is forced to dance around in red-hot metal slippers. I am destroying an archetype, the vital, fundamental belief in the inevitable victory of good over evil. Next, I get rid of the legend. I've never wanted to stand up to the dragon by the side of the invulnerable Siegfried. I've never been startled by a rustling in the dark woods. It's Rübezahl, the mountain sprite. We have differently named mountain sprites. Never having read animal fables, I no longer understand the meaning of phrases like fly as a fox or courageous, brave as a lion. Now that I no longer know Till Eulenspiegel, who is the famous European and Flemish trickster, I've never laughed at the tricks by which the weak overcomes the powerful. The wise men of Gotham, Don Quixote, Gulliver, the various beautiful princesses, away with them all. Away with impotently thundering Zeus, which shows sometimes that the most powerful have clay feet. Away with the cosmic ash tree, away with Adam and Eve in paradise, in, of course, the most influential piece of literature, the Bible. Never was there a city named Troy besieged and captured for a woman's sake, and never has Dr. Faust fought the devil for his soul, and thus become the prototype of the ever-striving scientist who researches for the sake of finding it all because it's possible, never thinking of the consequences. I enter my 10th year poor, robbed of all I own, naked and defenseless. I have not learned to know the joyful relief when a hero is rescued. I have never been inspired to tell myself fantastic dreams in the dark, and I do not know that people of different nationalities are different and yet alike. My moral code is undeveloped. I'm wasting away intellectually. My imagination is withered. I find it hard to draw comparisons, make judgments. Beautiful and ugly, good and evil are wavering, uncertain concepts. I am in bad shape. Irreplaceable above all is the knowledge that life's abundance is not exhausted by the few actions which chance permits us to perform. And lest you think that Christa Wolf and I are making too much of the power of literature, just remember how very serious repressive government takes literature. What, after all, is a dissident or subversive literature all about, if not hope for a better society? The book burnings of the Nazis, an example, of course, the exiled German authors, Ingo and Hans Scholl, the young brother and sister who were executed for their anti-Nazi activities, had been influenced by the philosophy of freedom, hope for freedom, in Friedrich Schiller's drama. The secretly printed and disseminated literature of the dissident Russian authors group, the Samizdat, provided hope for thousands and put the authors in constant danger of their lives. Or consider Salman Rushdie, whose sly criticism of the repressive old men in Iran. What else does it transmit but a faint hope for something better? The most moving, in fact, gut-wrenching example of a novel informed by desperate hope against hope I have recently read is T. Cora Jessen Boyle's Tortilla Curtain, an incredible monument to the human spirit, and its author is not being censored. It's appeared in this country, so maybe there is hope for us. My time's up. Consider the most My time is up. But remember Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. So let's keep reading and let's get our young people into literature. Thank you.
Words can heal. Words can wound. Hope can heal. Hope can hinder. A famous Vietnamese Zen master, poet, and peace activist in one of his essays proposed the idea that hope can be a hindrance, an obstacle. Thinking about it, I agree. I have a handful of words I hold dear, verbal worry stones. I have about 10 or 11 of these. Hope is not one of them, interestingly enough. Hope is a future word to me, a word of outside forces. Hope is a first step, a wishing step. When I received word in December that one of my old and dear friends, my second father, was so ill he was not expected to live until the end of the month, till the new year, I prayed for healing, I hoped he would get better. When Jose went in for an angiogram a few years ago, I was filled with a certain hope that everything would be okay and he would be coming home that night. I prefer the word faith. Faith is looking the situation in the face, being as humbly honest as possible, recognizing that my truth may not be someone else's, and planning and taking action appropriately. When Jose went in for the angiogram, he was talking about the different possible outcomes. I refused to see him. There was no other. Everything was going to be okay. And left myself and therefore my family unprepared. Looking back, if I'd been prepared, we might have made the same decision. But I think we would have felt more in control because we would have had a chance to think about them a little bit more and think about the rightness for us. And there would have been, for me, fewer lingering regrets. When I heard about my friend in December, Jose and I decided to make an unexpected roundabout 6-hour trip to see my friend and his family at Christmas. My friend and our mutual families enjoyed a good conversation and what seemed like a great meal of Kentucky Fried Chicken. I let him know he was an important person in my life. I prayed for his healing. I think a prayer is a positive action. They have shown it will heal people. It does help heal people. And had his name added to a prayer hotline for healing. He was able to resolve some religious concerns he had, and he died. Healing is not always what we choose. We don't always get to choose the form of healing. He died the next month, a few days after he could no longer sit up, a few days after hospice had to be called. He actually had two medical miracles earlier in his life. Two times earlier in his life, he was supposed to be dead, and he decided he wasn't going to be. So, you know, this was the third miracle. We just got it in a little bit different form. I'm very glad I got to see him again and talk to him again before he died, and while I could still see his hawk spirit shining. The literature I like gives me not just hope, but calls me to take faith, action in simple and humble words, to find who has my smile when I've lost it, to figure out as simply as possible what I need, like Juan Bobo, and like the mother in the closing words, which Barbara will be reading for us, by Langston Hughes, to keep turning corners, even while I'm going in the dark. People would like discussion. Would the other three people like to come up and no?
Obviously not.
Okay. Did anybody have any questions or any comments?
I just had a thought. I was thinking about some of the people who went through the concentration camps and how they kept positive views of life. I don't know how to do this, but it's going to be things that can be doing some things to
it. Yeah, I read a book.
It came out that people.
Yeah, and yeah, there was one of the books I read was by a survivor of the concentration camp, and he talked about the different ways people approached dealing with it.
If I can add that is one personal bit of knowledge, my father was in a Russian camp that they took over from the German concentration camp, and he died, and one of the survivors wrote a letter to my mother. And he happened to have a little book by a French author, and I forgot the name, that contained a lot of philosophical, hopeful, positive things. And he often would read to the other people from the book, which made them not whole and hearty, but feel better. And he died.
I was just going to recommend a book mentioned to you about to answer your question about how the people survive. You know, grading expository exams for world literature, and there's one of the 10th graders I'm writing about called Night by Eli Riesel. Yeah, I haven't read the book myself, but I know an awful lot, probably because a lot of the students have been writing about it. That's a very good book to read to get a sense of some of it is about the relationship between the father and the son, and how they brought each other through the father eventually.
Yeah, that was just a quick, I'll put in my own thing. Eliza is Beautiful, like La Vie est Belle, was interesting. I saw that, and it was very interesting because I expected to be very downcast by the end of it, and instead it was a hopeful movie, because, and partly not just a hope but a faith, because he did take action to keep people hoping. Ruth, and then
one of my favorite books is an autobiography of Eugenia Ginsburg, who was a Russian professor and caught up in the purges, the Stalin purges, and taken off to Siberian exile. And totally innocent. She was separated from her two children and husband for many, many years. And as she's sitting in the boxcar with other prisoners, she begins to recite Pushkin from memory. She had this tremendous memory. And a guard came in and said, and listened to this and said, "No books are allowed in here." Mm-hmm. And someone said, "This woman is reciting from memory." Mm-hmm. And the whole book gives you this tremendous triumph of the human spirit and adversity and the role of literature and poetry for these people in keeping their spirits alive. And then another comment I have is, during World War I, my father was a soldier in France, and he always had Marcus Aurelius, the Roman Stoic, writings with him, sort of kept his spirit up.
Yes, the human spirit, you know, occurring in a family.
we didn't just bring a book or two, we'd come out with groceries next. When I was a teenager, my mom bought the Great Books of the Western World. And I thought, oh, you know, that was a waste. But along with the Great Books came a self-study program for teenagers. And so basically for 4 years, I read the Great Books on my own. And there would be little quizzes and discussions, or with yourself, questions. And I swear that I got more education from reading Great Books than I did from going to high school. High school was a sidebar, you know. But I got to read the Great Books, and it just opened up these worlds and worlds of different perspectives and authors and, you know, all over the map that I would have never understood before. So it really just opened my entire universe to that concept. But yeah. My mom had probably learned that early on in reading.
That was normal. Yeah. There's another thing that I didn't think of when I was writing my thing, but it's kind of interesting because what I've chosen for hopeful literature has changed through the years. Like earlier I had different stories that I felt, you know, really struck a chord with me emotionally, and now, you know, it's like I thought about reading one of those and I go, that one doesn't do it anymore. Where Juan Bobo did, I mean, this, you know, keep it simple, stupid or bobo or whatever. kind of, that makes more sense sometimes these days. And sometimes, too, these days I tend less to the ones where the fairy tale, everything comes out right. And instead to some of the ones where it's like, well, things aren't perfect, but we keep going anyway. So, if there's no more comments, I guess we'll take offertory and have joys and sorrows.
Okay. First, let's thank you.
Offerings of money and offerings of service. Funny lines on the sheet. One sheet to look at on one.
Oh, I got a joint. I'll start out.
Oh, good.
Good. Unfortunately, we didn't figure out ahead of time to have the same space thing that way, but we've added some, Jose and I went out and got a few things to kind of brighten up the sanctuary area here.
Yeah,
and they're from different. The stained glass window is a Wisconsin artist. The little stained glass window in the window. And then we have I think they're called stoles, like a minister's stoles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's from, I believe, Pakistan. And the little fabric picture is from South America, and I can't remember whether it's Ecuador or what. Ecuador, Peru?
Ecuador.
And those, the two fabric pieces were got at the, is it the train station, the old train station?
Global Express.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful thing where you can get things from all over the world, and it's from, I think, UNICEF or.
We had 10 crafts from about 60 developing countries. Well, I tell new customers wanted to see one from every country. I would be hard put to try them. Really, it's fascinating to see what can be made, and the idea is to help the artists who can sell their own product to their own communities, and other people there know that they have a skill and can make baskets just as well as they can. So, help as a non-for-profit shop.
I'd like to personally thank, on behalf of the congregation, Kay and Jose's generous gift to us.
We're still working on the PA. It works fine. You guys work fine when the service is not here. So far, we haven't had a
But there is hope.
The story behind that is when we had the church across the street, lay ministry that Orrin Schrader did. I think Kay went to the Greek Orthodox Church.
Oh, no, I went to the Baptist Church.
You went to the Baptist Church?
Yes.
Okay, well, Kay went to the Greek Orthodox Church and was talking about all the wonderful art that they had in their church, all the color, all the light. And so part of Kay and Jose's gift was to bring more art into Prairie and art that sort of reflects Prairie as a community. And so the PA system is going to be what we'll be using during services, which should enable everyone, unless they're completely deaf, to hear, even in the hallway. It's a wonderful system with the boom for the choir, so we can get super fantastic sound and hearing. And then the two wall hanging and the stained glass window add to that too. So on behalf of Prairie, I thank you both. Okay, let's see, what's next here? Ground cover shade loving plants, promised to people last fall, are here to take today. They are bare root and must be kept watered until in the ground and mechy.
Aren't they more joy? Is there no more time for joy?
I'm sorry.
I apologize, I keep sort of felt like a joy on an announcement that was on my announcement list. Okay, back to joy. I had an unexpected joy a couple of weeks ago. A young African American fellow was here, his name is Chris, and he was from what used to be Channing Murray. Some of you were here, and he talked me into coming last night to a soulful sundown that the young people did at FUF, and it was sort of, as he said, an intergenerational talent show. Of course, I was being told an old but I did do something, and there was a mixture of wonderful talent. I mean, there were some 12-year-old kids, too, and I just wanted to recommend looking into what the young people are doing. They're really great. And it was like a loosely connected service, you know, with a little bit of an introduction and so forth. And then people, those of us who did something for the talent show, I did some music stuff, of course, and talked and shared some experiences. And the whole mood was really extremely pleasant and relaxed and open. And I highly recommend looking into that if any of you want to do some stuff with the young people. So that was a great joy for me.
Thank you. Currently, Bob Park and Dee Skoker are Channing Murray representatives.
Yeah, right.
Whatever phrase you want to use to describe that activity.
Yeah.
And you know, I encourage everyone to go to that. We get up Prairie, the news, the weekly newsletter of activities.
Yeah.
And Bob Park is where else you can find that too. So. Yes.
Speaking of young people, we had three. Brian, and Ian went to the YRUU conference in Rockford this weekend. Came back happy and tired, I would say. But they look like they have a really good time.
I received from one of them some lifesavers if we're talking about hope. And there's a chalice on here, and it says, "I've been saved. I'm a Unitarian Universalist." That was a joy about the weekend, Brian. Other joys or sorrows, Phoenix?
I have more half my fundraising fun.
Maybe we should put the deadline in the newsletter. Yeah, see Marilyn about that. Deadlines are helpful.
All right, one more joy. I stopped at Tara Converse's house the other night because I heard she was going to London for this school holiday.
And Randy was standing out in front, and she had just won a scholarship to go to Japan.
Oh! Oh.
Yes, Rosemary. One brief thing, if I may, I just heard from Karen Gross today
but the deadline had already passed, so we're very glad that she's representing us this year. Board meeting Tuesday, April 25th at 7 p.m. This is the current board, also known as the old board, but as all board meetings are open to anyone, anyone may attend. Any announcements I missed?
Please do see me on the plan for the Miller.
Okay.
We gotta go home today.
Our last hymn will be number 270. Oh, wow.
Sorry, I've been away for a week, so I'm a little out of the loop. But we moved spring fling. Originally, it was last night, but it didn't happen last night. It was a spring conference. So it'll be April 29th. And right now, we are passively recruiting teachers. And soon we'll be actively recruiting teachers. So if anybody is interested in teaching religious education, next year, speak to myself or Rachel or Ann or Larry. Anybody in the other community.
Marilyn.
I'd like to introduce Mike Nilipovich from Stoughton. He expressed a desire to come visit us, and so we picked him up today, and hope he's enjoying him.
Okay, any other introductions? Announcements? Okay, I think we are here now for our last hymn, which is number 270, O Day of Light and Gladness.
This one I
can pick. Still climbing, and life for me ain't been no crystal stair.
have beverages and ourselves to amuse ourselves with.